Stone Telling, Part 1. Stone Telling is my last name. It has come to me of my own choosing, because I have a story to tell of where I went when I was young. But now I go nowhere, sitting like a stone in this place, in this ground, in this valley. I have come where I was going. My house is the blue clay, my household the high porch of Sinshan. My mother was named Tohi, Willow, and Ashes. My father's name, Abhau, in the valley means kills. In Sinshan, babies' names often come from birds, since they are messengers. In the month before my mother bore me, an owl came every night to the oak trees called Gairga outside the windows of High Porch House on the north side, and sang the owl's song there. So my first name was North Owl. High Porch is an old house, well built, with large rooms. The beams and frame are redwood, the walls of adobe brick and plaster, the flooring oak, the windows of clear glass in small square panes. The balconies of High Porch are deep and beautiful. The great-grandmother of my grandmother was the first to live in our rooms, on the first floor, under the roof. When the family was big, they needed the whole floor, but my grandmother was the only one of her generation, and so we lived in the two west rooms only. We could not give much. We had the use of 10 wild olives and several other gathering trees on Sinshan Ridge, and a seed clearing on the east side of Wakyahum, and planted potatoes and corn and vegetables in one of the plots on the creek southeast of Adobe Hill. But we took much more corn and beans from the storehouses than we gave. My grandmother, Valiant, was a weaver. When I was a small child, she had no sheep in the family, and so gave most of what she wove for wool to weave more. The first thing I remember of being alive is that my grandmother's fingers moved across the warp of the loom, forth and back, a silver crescent bracelet shining on her wrist below the red sleeve. The second thing I remember is that I went up to the spring of our creek in the fog in early morning in the winter. It was my first time as a blue clay child to dip up water for the new moon wakwa. I was so cold I cried. The older children laughed at me and said I had spoiled the water by crying into it. I believed them and began to bawl because I had spoiled the water. My grandmother was officiating, and she told me the water was all right, and let me carry the moon jar all the way back to town. But I bawled and sniveled all the way, because I was cold and ashamed, and the jar of spring water was cold and heavy. I can feel that cold and wet and weight now, in old age, and see the dead arms of Manzanita black in fog, and hear the voices laughing and talking before me, and behind me on the steep path beside the creek. I go there, I go there, I go where I went, crying beside the water. It goes there, the fog along the water. I did not spend much time crying, maybe not enough. My mother's father said, laugh first, cry later, cry first, laugh later. He was a serpentine man from Chumo and had gone back to that town to live with his mother's people. That was all right with my grandmother. She said once, living with my husband is like eating unleached acorns. But she went down to visit him from time to time in Chumo, and he would come and stay with us in the hills in summer, when Chumo was baking like a biscuit down on the valley floor. His sister, Green Drum, was a famous summer dancer, but his family never gave anything. He said they were poor because his mother and grandmother had given everything in past years putting on the summer dances at Chumo. My grandmother said they were poor because they didn't like working. They may both have been right. The only other human people directly in my family lived in Madidino. My grandmother's sister had gone there to live, and her son had married a red adobe woman there. We often visited, and I played with my second cousins, a girl and boy, called Pelican and Hops. Our family animals when I was a small child were Himpy, Poultry, and a cat. Our cat was black without a white hair, handsome, mannerly, and a great hunter. We traded her kittens for Himpy, so that for a while we had a big pen of Himpy. I looked after them and the chickens and kept cats out of the runs and pens down under the lower balconies. When I began staying with the animals, I was still so small that the green-tailed cock frightened me. He knew it, and would come at me jerking his neck and swearing, and I would scramble over the divider into the Himpy run to escape him. The Himpy would come out and sit up and whistle at me. They were a comfort to me, even more than kittens. I learned not to name them, and not to trade them alive for eating, but to kill quickly those I traded, since some people kill animals without care or skill, causing fear and pain. I cried enough to suit even my grandfather after the night a sheepdog went amok and got into the run and slaughtered every Himpy but a few nestlings. I could not speak to a dog for months after that. But it turned out well for my family, since the sheepdog's people gave us a ewe in lamb to make up for the loss of our Himpy. The ewe bore twin ewe lambs, and so my mother was a shepherd again, and my grandmother had family wool to spin and weave. I do not remember learning to read and dance. My grandmother was teaching me from before the time I began to speak and walk. When I was 5, I began going to the hayamas with the other blue clay children, mornings, and later I studied with teachers in the hayamas and in the blood, oak, and mole lodges. I learned the salt journey. I studied a little with the poet Ire, and a long time with the potter Clay Sun. I was not quick to learn, and never considered going to a school in one of the great towns, though several children of Tsinshan did so. I liked learning in the hayamas, taking part in a structure larger than my own knowledge, in which I could find relief from feelings of fear and anger, which, unaided, I could not understand or get past. Yet I did not learn as much as I might have done, but always hung back and said, "I can't do that." Some of the children, ill-meaning or ignorant, called me Huikmas, half-house. I had also heard people say of me, "She is half a person." I understood this in my own way, badly, since it was not explained to me at home. I had not the courage to ask questions at the hayamas, or to go where I might have learned about matters outside the little town of Tsinshan, and begun to see the valley as a part of a whole, as well as a whole. Since neither my mother nor her mother spoke of him in the first years of my life, all I knew of my father was that he had come from outside the valley and had gone away again. This meant to me only that I had no father's mother, no father's house, and therefore was a half-person. I had not even heard of the Condor people. I had lived 8 years before we went to the hot springs in Kastohana to treat my grandmother's rheumatism, and in the commonplace there saw men of the Condor. I will tell that journey. It was a small journey many years ago. It is a journey of the still air. We got up in the darkness of a morning, about a month past the world dance. I gave some meat I had saved to the black cat, Sidi, who was growing old. I had thought she would be hungry while we were away, and the thought had worried me for days. My mother told me, "You eat that. The cat will catch what she needs." My mother was stern and reasoning. My grandmother said, "The child is feeding her soul. Let be." We put out the hearth fire and left the door open a little for the cat and the wind. We went down the stairs under the last stars. The houses looked like hills in the darkness. Dark. Out on the commonplace it seemed lighter. We crossed the hinge and went to the blue clay hayamas. Shell was waiting for us there. She was a member of the doctor's lodge and had treated my grandmother's pain, and they were old friends. They filled the water basin and sang the return together. When we came up into the dancing place, the light was beginning. Shell came back across the hinge with us and through town, and after we crossed the bridge over Tsinshan Creek, we all squatted there under the live oaks and pissed, and said, "Go well, stay well," laughing. That was how Lower Valley people used to do when they left on a journey, but only old people remember it now. Then Shell went back, and we went on past the barns, between the creeks, across Sinshan fields. The sky above the hills across the valley began to be yellow and red. Where we were in the middle, the woods and hills were green. Behind us, Sinshan Mountain was blue and dark. So we walked in the arm of life. Birds were singing their different songs in the air, in the trees, and in the fields. As we came to Amio Path and turned northwest to face Grandmother Mountain, the southeast mountains let go the sun's edge, white. Now I walk that way in that light. My grandmother Valiant felt well and walked easily that morning, and she said, "Let's go and see our family in Madidino." So we went that way, towards the sun, and came there along Sinshan Creek, where the wild and domestic geese and ducks were feeding and talking in great numbers in the cattail marshes. I had been to Madidino many times, of course, but this time the town looked altogether different, since I was on a journey beyond it. I felt serious and important, and did not want to play with my red adobe cousins, though they were the children I loved best. My grandmother visited a while with her daughter-in-law. Her son died before my birth, and her grandchildren's stepfather. And then we went on our way, crossing the plum and apricot orchards to the old straight road. I had been past and across the old straight road with my Madidino cousins, but now I was going to walk on it. I felt important but awed, and whispered Heya for the first 9 steps. People said it was the oldest work of hands in all the valley, that nobody knew how long there had been a road there. Parts of it were indeed straight, but other parts went curving off towards the river, and then came back to the straight. In the dust were marks of feet, sheep's hooves, donkey's hooves, dog's paws, people's feet shod, people's feet bare, so many tracks of feet that I thought they must be all the tracks of all the people that had ever walked on the road for 50,000 years. Great valley oaks stood along the sides of the road to give windbreak and shade, and in places elms or poplars or huge white eucalyptus so vast and twisted that they looked older than the road, but it was so wide that even the morning shadows did not reach across it. I thought that because it was so old, it had to be wide. But my mother explained that it was wide because the big flocks of the upper valley went along it to the saltgrass prairies at the mouths of the Na after the world, and came back up valley after the grass, and some of those flocks were of 1,000 sheep or more. They had all gone by, and we met only a couple of dung carts following after the last of them, with a group of shitty and raucous adolescents from Telina shoveling up dung for the fields. They called all sorts of jokes at us, and my mother's replied laughing, but I hid my face. There were some other travelers on the road, and when they greeted us, again I hid my face each time. But once they were past, I stared after them and asked so many questions, who are they? Where are they coming from? Where are they going? That Valiant began to laugh at me and answer me with jokes. Because she was lame, we went slowly, and because it was all new to me, the way seemed immensely long to me. But by mid-morning we came through the vineyards to Telina Na. I saw that town rise beside the Na, the great barns, the walls and windows of its houses among the oaks, the roofs of the Hayamas, high-stepped, red and yellow around the bannered dancing place, a town like a bunch of grapes, like a cock pheasant, rich, elaborate, amazing, beautiful. My grandmother's half-sister's son was living in Telina Na in a red adobe household, and that family had sent word to us to stay with them on our way. Telina was so much bigger than Sinshan that I thought there was no end to it, and that household was so much bigger than ours that I thought there was no end to them. Actually, they were only 7 or 8, living in the ground floor of Hard Cinder House, but other relatives and friends kept coming and going, and there was so much working and talking and cooking and bringing and taking that I thought this household must be the wealthiest in the world. They heard me whisper to my grandmother, "Look, There are 7 cooking pots. They all laughed at that. I was ashamed at first, but they kept repeating what I had said and laughing with so much good nature that I began saying things to make them laugh more. After I said, "This household is huge, like a mountain," my half-uncle's wife, Vine, said, "Come and live with us a while in this mountain, then, you North Owl. We have 7 pots, but no daughter. We need one." She meant that. She was the center of all that giving and taking and flowing, a generous person. But my mother did not let the words come to her, and my grandmother smiled, but said nothing. That evening my red adobe cousins, Vine's 2 sons, and some other children of the household, took me all around to Lena. Hardcinder House is one of the inner houses of the left-hand common place. In the center place, a horse race was going on, a wonder to me who had never dreamed of a common place big enough to hold a horse race on. I had not seen many horses, for that matter. In Sinshan, it was donkey races in a cow pasture. The course was around the place, leftwards, reverse, and back around rightwards to make the Heia If. People were up in the balconies and out on the roofs with oil and battery lamps, betting and drinking and shouting, and the horses ran through shadow and flashing lights, turning as fast as swallows, the riders yipping and yelling. Over in some balconies of the right-hand place, people were singing, getting ready for the summer dancing. 2 quail run, 2 quail rise. Over in the dancing place, they were singing down in the serpentine Hayamas too, but we only went by there on the way to the river. Down among the willows, there where the lights from the town made a little gleaming among the shadows, couples had come away to enjoy privacy. We children sneaked around looking for them in the willow thickets, and when we found a couple, my cousins would yell, "Holy mole, there's sand in the hole!" or make rude noises, and the couple would get up swearing and come after us, and we would scatter and run. If those cousins of mine did that every warm night, there wasn't much need for contraceptives in Telina. When we got tired, we went back to the house and ate some cold beans and went to sleep on the balconies and porches. All night we heard them singing the quail song over the way. Next morning we 3 left early, though not before daybreak, and a good breakfast. As we crossed the Na on the arched stone bridge, my mother held my hand. She did not do that often. I thought she did it because it was sacred to cross the river. I think now she was afraid to lose me. She thought she should let me stay in the rich town with those rich relatives. When we were away from Telina Na, her mother said to her, "For the winter, perhaps, Willow?" My mother said nothing. I did not think anything about it. I was happy and talked the whole way to Chumo about the wonderful things I had seen and heard and done in Telina Na. All the time I talked, my mother held my hand. We came into Chumo hardly knowing we had come into it. The houses are so scattered out and hidden among trees. We were to spend the night at our Heimas there, but first we went to visit my grandmother's husband, my mother's father. He had a room of his own with some of his yellow adobe relatives in a single-story house under oaks in sight of the creek, a pretty place. His room, which was his workroom, was large and dank. Up till then I had always known my grandfather by his middle name, Potter, but he had changed his name. He told us to call him Corruption. I thought that was a crazy name, and being puffed up by the laughter of the family in Telina when I made jokes, I said to my mother, pretty loudly, "Does he stink?" My grandmother heard and said, "Be quiet. It's nothing to joke about." I felt bad and foolish, but my grandmother didn't seem to be cross with me. When the other people of the house had gone back to their rooms, leaving us with my grandfather in his room, she said to him, "What kind of name have you let come to you?" He said, "A true name." He looked different from the way he had looked the summer before in Sinshan. He had always been gloomy and complaining. Nothing was ever right, and nobody ever did things right except himself, although he never did anything much because the time wasn't right. Now he still looked grim and sour, but he behaved with importance. He said to Valiant, "There's no use going to the hot springs for a cure. You'd do better staying home and learning how to think." How do you learn that? She asked. He said, You have to learn that your pains and aches are merely an error in thinking. Your body is not real. I think it's real, Valiant said, and she laughed and slapped her hips. Like this? Corruption said. He was holding the wooden paddle he used to smooth the outside of the big clay storage jars he made. The paddle was carved of olive wood, as long as my arm, and a handspan wide. He held it up in his right hand, brought his left hand up towards it, and passed it through his left hand. It went through muscle and bone like a knife through water. Valiant and Willow stared at the paddle and the hand. He motioned to them to let him do the same thing to them. They did not put up their hands. But I was curious and wanted to go on having attention paid to me, so I held up my right arm. Corruption reached out the paddle and passed it through my arm between wrist and elbow. I felt the soft motion of it. It felt as a candle flame feels when you pass a finger through it. It made me laugh with surprise. My grandfather looked at me and said, This North Owl might come to the warriors. It was the first time I had heard that word. Valiant said, and I could tell she was angry, No chance of that. Your warriors are all men. She can marry one, said my grandfather. When the time comes, she can marry Dead Sheep's son. You can go do such and such with your dead sheep, Valiant said, which made me laugh again, but Willow touched her arm to quieten her. I don't know whether my mother was frightened by the power her father had shown, or by the quarreling between her father and mother. Anyhow, she restored quiet behavior between them. We drank a glass of wine with my grandfather, and then we walked with him to the dancing place of Chumo and to the blue clay Hayamas. We spent the night there in their guest room, the first night I had slept underground. I liked the silence and stillness of the air, but was not used to it, and kept waking in the night and listening, and only when I heard my mother's breathing could I sleep again. There were some other people Valiant wanted to see in Chumo, where she had lived when she learned tapestry weaving, and we did not leave that town till near noon. As we went along the northeast side of the river, the valley narrowed in, and the road went among orchards of olive, plum, and nectarine, among hills terraced with vines. I had never been so close to the mountain, and it filled my eyes. When I looked back, I could not see Tsinshan Mountain. Its shape had changed, or other mountains of the southwest side had hidden it. That alarmed me. I finally spoke of it to my mother, who understood my fear and reassured me that when we returned to Tsinshan, our mountain would be where it belonged. After we crossed the Weather Creek, we could see the town of Chukalmas up in the hills across the valley, its fire tower standing up by itself, built of colored stones, red, orange, and yellowish-white, patterned as finely as a basket or a snake. Cattle grazed in the yellow pasture bays on the foothills, between the arms of the woods. On the narrowed, flat floor of the valley were many wineries and fruit-drying sheds, and the orcharders from Chukalmas were putting up summer houses. Beside the Na, the dark mills loomed among the oaks, their wheels making a sound you could hear for a long way. Quail were calling the three-note call, and larks went up from the fields, and the buzzards turned very high up. The sunlight was clear. The air was still. My mother said, This is a day of the ninth house. My grandmother said only, I'll be glad to get to Kastoha. Since we left Chumo, she had been silent and walked lame. There was a feather on the way before my mother's feet, a gray-barred blue wing feather of a jay. It was the answer to what she had said. She picked it up and held it as she walked. She was a small woman, round-faced, with fine hands and feet, barefoot that day, wearing old buckskin trousers and a sleeveless shirt, carrying a little backpack, her hair braided and coiled, a blue feather in her hand. So she walks in the sunlight in the still air. Shadows were coming across the valley from the western hills when we came to Kastohana. Valiant saw the roofs above the orchards and said, Aha, there's Granny's twat. Old people used to call Castoja that because it is between the spread legs of the mountain. Hearing it called that, I had imagined the town to be set among fir and redwood trees, and to be a cave, dark and mysterious, with the river running out of it. When we came across the Knob Bridge, and I saw it was a big town like Telina, only bigger yet, with hundreds of houses and more people than I knew were in the world, I began crying. Maybe it was shame that made me cry, because I saw how silly I had been to think that a town could be a cave. Maybe I was frightened or tired from all I had seen in the days and nights of our journey. Valiant took my right arm in her hands and felt it and looked at it. She had not done that after corruption had put the paddle through it. Nothing at all had been said about that. "He's an old fool," she said now, "and so am I." She took off the silver crescent bracelet which she always wore and slipped it over my hand onto my right arm. "There," she said. "It won't fall off, North Owl." She was so thin that the crescent was only a little large for my small arm, but that was not what she meant. I stopped crying. In the lodging house by the hot springs that night, I slept, but while I slept, I knew all night that the moon was on my arm, under my head. On the next day, I saw the condor for the first time. Everything in Castoja now was strange to me. Everything was new. Everything was different from home. But as soon as I saw those men, I knew that Tsinshan and Castoja were all one thing, the same thing. And this was a different thing. I was like a cat that scents a rattlesnake or a dog that sees a ghost. My legs got stiff, and I could feel the air on my head because my hair was trying to stand up. I stopped short and said in a whisper, "What are they?" My grandmother said, "Men of the Condor, men of no house." My mother was beside me. She went forward very suddenly and spoke to the four tall men. They turned to her, beaked and winged, looking down at her. My legs went weak then, and I wanted to piss. I saw black vultures stooping on my mother, stretching out their red necks, their pointed beaks, staring with eyes ringed with white. They pulled things out of her mouth and belly. She came back to us, and we walked on towards the hot springs. She said, "He's been in the north, in the volcano country. Those men say the condor are coming back. They knew his name when I said it. They said he is an important person. Did you see how they listened when I said his name?" My mother laughed. I had never heard her laugh that way. Valiant said, "Whose name?" Willow said, "My husband's name." They had stopped again, facing each other. My grandmother shrugged and turned away. "I tell you, he's coming back," my mother said. I saw white sparkles crowding all around her face like flies of light. I cried out, and then I began to vomit and crouched down. "I don't want it to eat you," I kept saying. My mother carried me back to the lodging house in her arms. I slept a while, and in the afternoon I went with Valiant to the hot springs. We lay a long time in the hot water. It was brownish blue and full of mud and smelled of sulfur, very disagreeable at first, but once you were in it, you began to feel like floating in it forever. The pool was shallow, wide, and long, lined with blue-green glazed tiles. There were no walls, but a high roof of timbers. Screens could be set against the wind. It was a lovely place. All the people there had come there for healing and talked only quietly or lay alone in the water singing soft, healing songs. The blue-brown water hid their bodies, so looking down the long pool you could only see heads resting on the water, leaning back against the tiles, some with eyes closed, some singing in the mist that hung above the hot springs. I lie there, I lie where I lay, floating in the shallow water. It floats there, the mist above the water. The lodging house of the hot springs of Castohana was our household for a month. Valiant bathed in the waters and went daily to the doctor's lodge to learn the copper snake. My mother went alone up onto the mountain to the springs of the river, to Wakwaha, and on to the summit in the tracks of the mountain lion. A child could not spend all day in the hot pool and the doctor's lodge, but I was afraid of the crowded commonplaces of the big town, and we had no relatives in the houses, so I stayed mostly at the hot springs and helped with the work. When I learned where the geyser was, I went there often. An old man who lived there and guided visitors about the Heya place and sang the story of the rivers underground used to talk to me and let me help him. He taught me a mud wakwa, the first song I received for myself. Not many people even then knew that song, which must be very old. It is in an old form, sung alone, with a two-note wooden drum, and most of the words are matrix, so it is no good for writing. The old man said, maybe the people of the sky houses sing this one when they come to bathe at the mud baths here. Inside the matrix at one place in the song, the other words come out and say, from the edges inward to the middle, downward, upward, to the middle, all these have come in here. They are all coming in here. I think the old man was right, and it is an earth song. It was my first gift, and I have given it to many. Keeping out of the town, I saw no more men of the Condor, and I forgot them. After a month, we went home to Sinshan in time to dance the summer dances. Valiant was feeling well, and we walked down the valley to Telinana in one morning, and then on to Sinshan in the evening. When we got to the bridge across Sinshan Creek, I was seeing everything backwards. The hills in the north were where the south hills should be. The houses on the right hand were where the houses on the left should be. Even inside our house it was like that. I went around all the places I knew, finding everything turned around. It was strange. But I enjoyed this strangeness, though I hoped it would not remain. In the morning, when I woke up with Siddhi purring in my ear, everything was where it belonged, north in the north and left to the left, and I have never seen the world backwards again, or only for a moment. After the last of the summer was danced, we went up to our summer house, and there Valiant said to me, North Owl, in a few years you will begin to be a woman, bleeding woman's blood, and last year you were only a grasshopper, but here you are now in the middle, a good place, your clear water years. What do you want to do in this place? I thought about it for a day and told her, I want to go up in the tracks of the lion. She said, good. My mother did not ask or answer. Since we came back from Kastohana, she was always as if listening for a word, listening far away, holding still. So my grandmother made me ready to go. For 9 days I ate no meat, and for the last 4 of the 9 I ate only raw food, once a day at midday, and drank water 4 times a day in 4 draughts. Then I woke up early, before light, and got up and took the pouch with gifts in it. Valiant was sleeping, but I thought my mother was lying awake. I whispered Heya to them, and to the house, and went out. Our summer house was in a meadow up in the hills over Hard Canyon Creek, a mile or so upstream from Sinshan. We had gone there for the summers of all my life with a family of obsidian people of Chimbam House, mingling our sheep. There was good pasture for them up the hills, and the creek ran right through to the rains most years. The name of the meadow was Gaheya, for the blue serpentine Heya rock in the northwest part of it. As I left, I went past that rock, Gaheya. I was going to stop and speak to it, but it was speaking to me. It said, don't stop, go on, go high before the sun. So I went on up across the high hills, walking while it was still dark, running when it began to be light, and I was on the high ridge of Sinshan Mountain when the earth's curve and the sun's curve parted. I saw light fall on the southeast side of all things, and the darkness turn away across the sea. After singing Hey Ya There, I walked along the ridge of the mountain from northwest to southeast, following deer paths through the chaparral and making my own way where the underbrush was thinner under the fir and pine forests, not going quickly, but very slowly, stopping all the time and listening and looking for directions and signs. The whole day long I kept worrying about where I would sleep the night. I crossed and recrossed the ridges of the mountain, always thinking, I must find a good place. I must come to a good place. No place seemed to be good. I said to myself, it should be a Heya place. You'll know it when you come to it. But what I was really holding in my mind, without thinking about it, was the puma and the bear, wild dogs, men from the coast, strangers from the beach country. What I was looking for was a hiding place. So I walked all day long, and every time I stopped anywhere, I was trembling. Having gone above the springs, I was thirsty when it got dark. I ate 4 seed pollen balls from my gift pouch, but after eating I felt thirstier and a little sick. Dusk had come up onto the mountain before I had found the place I couldn't find, so I had stayed where I was, in a hollow under some manzanita trees. The hollow seemed to shelter me, and manzanitas are pure heia. I sat a long time there. I tried to sing heia, but did not like the sound of my voice alone there. I lay down at last. Whenever I moved at all, the dry manzanita leaves shouted, Listen, she's moving. I tried to lie still, but the cold kept making me curl up. It was cold up there, with the wind bringing a sea fog in over the mountain. Fog and night did not allow me to see, though I kept staring into the dark. All I could see was that I had wanted to come up on the mountain, and had expected to do everything right, to walk in the tracks of the lion, but instead I had come to nothing and had spent all day running away from lions. That was because I had not come up here to be the lion, but to show the children who called me a half-person that I was a better person than they were, that I was a brave and holy 8-year-old. I began to cry. I pushed my face into the dirt among the leaves and cried into the dirt, the mother of my mothers. So with my tears I made a small salt mud place up on that cold mountain. That made me think of the song that had come to me from the old man at the geysers, the mud wakwa, and I sang it in my mind. It helped me some. So the night went on being. Thirst and cold did not let me sleep, and weariness did not let me wake. As soon as light began to come, I went down from the ridge to find water, going down through thick brush in one of the canyon heads. It was a long way I went before a spring let me find it. I was in a maze of canyons and got turned around, and when I came up onto the ridges again, I was in between Sinshan Mountain and She Watches. I went on up till I came to a big, bald foothill from which I could look back and see Sinshan Mountain facing me from the wrong side, the outside. I was outside the valley. I kept going all that day as I had the day before, walking slowly and stopping, but my mind was changed. It was not thinking, yet it was clear. All I said to myself was, Try to be on a way that goes around this mountain she watches without going down or up much, and so come back to this bald place on this hill. There was a good feeling on that hill, where the wild oats were bright pale yellow in the sunlight. I thought I would find it again. So I went on. Everything that came to me I spoke to by name, or by saying Heya. The trees, fir and digger pine and buckeye and redwood and manzanita and madrone and oak, the birds, blue jay and bushtit and woodpecker and phoebe and hawk, the leaves of chamise and scrub oak and poison oak and flowering thorn, the grasses, a deer's skull, a rabbit's droppings, the wind blowing from the sea. Over there on the hunting side there were not many deer willing to come close to a human being. Deer came to my eyes 5 times, and once the coyote came. To the deer I said, I give you what blessing I can, silent ones. Give me what blessing you can. The coyote I called Singer. I had seen the coyote skulking at lambing time and stealing from the summer house, and dead, a bit of dirty fur, all my life, but I had not seen her in her house. She was standing between two digger pines about 20 feet from me, and she walked forward to see me better. She sat down with her tail around her feet and gazed. I think she could not figure out what I was. Maybe she had never seen a child. Maybe she was a young coyote and had never seen a human person. I liked the look of her, lean and neat, the color of wild oats in winter, with light eyes. I said, "Singer, I will go your way." She sat there gazing and seeming to smile, because the coyote's mouth goes in a smile. Then she stood up, stretched a little, and was gone, like a shadow. I could not see her go, so I could not go her way. But that night she and her family sang Coyote Wakwa near me half the night. The fog did not come in that night. The darkness stayed mild and clear, and all the stars revealed themselves. I felt light, lying at the side of a small clearing under old bay laurel trees, looking up at the star patterns. I began to float, to belong to the sky. So Coyote let me come into her house. The next day I came back to the wild oats hill that let me see the wrong side of Tsinshan Mountain, and there emptied out my pouch and gave the place my gifts. Without crossing the hill to close the circle, I went back down into the canyons between the mountains, intending to go around Tsinshan Mountain from the southeast, and so complete the Heiya If. In the canyons I got lost again. A creek led me on, because the going was easy alongside it, and all the sides of its gully were steep and thick with poison oak. I kept going on down it, and I do not know where I came to. The name of those canyons is Old Fox Hollows, but nobody, I asked later, hunters and Bay Lodge people, had ever seen the place I came to on that creek. It was a long, dark pool where the creek seemed to have stopped running. Around the pool grew trees I have not seen anywhere else, with smooth trunks and limbs and triangular, slightly yellow leaves. The water of the pool was speckled and drifted with those leaves. I put my hand into the water and asked it for directions. I felt power in it, and it frightened me. It was dark and still. It was not the water I knew, not the water I wanted. It was heavy, like blood, and black. I did not drink from it. I squatted there in the hot shade under those trees beside the water and looked for a sign or a word, trying to understand. On the water something came towards me, the water skater. It was a big one, moving quickly on its shining hollows in the skin of the water. I said, "I give you what blessing I can, Silent One. Give me what blessing you can." The insect stayed still a while there between air and water, where they meet, its place of being, and then it slid away into the shadow of the banks of the pool. That was all there. I got up, singing Heya Nanno, and found a way up past the poison oak to the top of the gully, and then got through Old Fox Hollows to Back Canyon, and so on to my own mountain in the heat of the late afternoon of midsummer, the crickets yammering like a thousand bells, and the blue jays and black-crested jays shouting and swearing at me all through the woods. That night I slept sound under live oaks on the side of my mountain. The next day, the fourth, I made feather wands with the feathers that had come to me while I walked, and sticks of the live oaks, and at a little seeping spring among rocks and roots at a canyon head, I made as much of the wakwa of the springs as I knew. After that I started going home. I got to Gaheya about the time the sun set, and came to the three-walled summer house. Willow was not there. Valiant was spinning in front of the house by the hearth. "Well," she said, "you'd better go have a bath, maybe." I knew she was very glad I was safe home, but she was laughing because I had forgotten to wash after making the wakwa, being in a hurry to get home and eat. I was all sweat and mud. Walking down to Hard Canyon Creek, I felt old, as if I had been away longer than 4 days, longer than the month in Kastohana, longer than the 8 years of my life. I washed in the creek and came back up the meadow in the twilight. Gaheya Rock was there, and I went to it. It said, "Now touch me." So I did. and so came home. I knew something had come to me that I did not understand, and maybe did not want from that strange place, the pool and the water skater. But the hinge of my walk had been the golden hill. The coyote had sung to me, and so long as my hand and the rock touched each other, I knew that I had not gone wrong, even if I had come to nothing. Because I had only one grandmother and grandfather in the valley, a blue clay man called Nine Point had asked to be side grandfather to me. As I was about to be 9 years old, he came over from their summer house in Bear Creek Canyon to teach me the songs of the fathers. Soon after that, we went back with him to Tsinshan to make ready to dance the water, while the Obsidian family at Gaheya looked after the sheep. This was the first time I had gone back to town in summer. Hardly anybody was there except blue clay people, singing and doing heia all day long. In the town that was empty and open, I began to feel my soul opening out and spreading out with the other souls of the dancers to fill the emptiness. The water poured out from the bowl of blue clay, and the songs were streams and pools in the great heat of summer. The other houses came in from the summering, and we danced the water. At Tachas Tochas, their creek had gone dry, so they came up from there to dance with us, those that had relatives going to them, and the others camping in Tsinshan fields or sleeping on balconies. With so many people there, the dancing never stopped, and the blue clay heiamas was so full of singing and power that touching the roof of it was touching a lion. It was a great wakwa. By the third and fourth days of it, people in Madidino and Telina had heard about the water in Tsinshan and came up to join. On the last night, the balconies were full of people, and the heia'if filled the whole dancing place, and in the sky the heat lightning danced in the southeast and northwest, and you could not tell the drums from the thunder, and we danced the rain down to the sea and up to the clouds again. Between the water and the wine, one day, I met my red adobe cousins from Madidino to pick blackberries at Hatch Quail Rock. The patches had all been picked over, and not many berries were there for us, so Pelican and I were wild dogs, and Hops was the hunter, and we hunted each other through those tight thorny paths between the blackberry brambles. I waited till Hops came past my hiding place, and leapt out at him from behind, barking loudly, and knocked him flat. It knocked the wind out of him, and he was cross for a while, until I whined and licked his hand. Then we all three sat and talked a long time. He said, "There were some people with birds' heads came through our town yesterday." I said, "What do you mean, feather gatherers?" He said, "No, men with heads like birds, buzzards or vultures, black and red." Pelican began shouting, "He didn't see them, I saw them." But I began to feel scared and sick. I said, "I have to go home now," and went off. My cousins had to run after me with the basket of berries I had picked. They went back to Madidino, and I went through Tsinshan fields across Hechu Creek. I was near the wineries when I looked up and saw a bird in the sky in the southwest, gyring. I thought it was a buzzard, but saw that it was bigger than a buzzard, that it was the Great One. 9 times it turned in the air above my town, and then, completing the heia'if, flew gliding slowly into the northeast, over me. Its wings, each one longer than a person is tall, never moved. Only the long feather fingers of the wing ends tilted in the wind. When it was gone over Red Cow Hill, I went hurrying on to Tsinshan. There were a lot of people on the balconies, and in the commonplace, some obsidian people were drumming up their courage. I went to High Porch House, into our second room, and hid behind the rolled-up beds in the dark corner. I believed I was the one the condor was looking for. My mother and grandmother came in, not knowing I was there, and talked. "I told you he's coming," my mother said. "He'll come and find us here." She spoke angrily and joyfully, as I had never heard her speak. "May it not happen," my grandmother said, angry, without joy. At that, I came out of the dark corner and ran to my grandmother, crying, Don't let it come. Don't let it come find us. My mother said, Come to me, Condor's daughter. I went part way and stopped. I stood between them and said, That is not my name. My mother was still for two breaths and then said, Don't be afraid. You'll see. She began setting out food to cook supper, as if nothing had happened or was happening. Valiant took her wood drum and went down to our hayamas. People drummed in all the hayamas that evening. It was in the last great heat of the year, and people were out on the balconies for the cool after dark. I heard people talking about the condor. Agate, the librarian of the Madrone, began to say a recital piece called The Flight of the Great One, which he had made from an old written record by a finder in the library. It told of the inland sea and the range of light, the Omorn Sea and the range of heaven, the deserts of sage and the prairies of grass, the mountain of the north and the mountain of the south, all as the condor would see them flying. Agate's voice was beautiful, and when he read or told, one listened and entered into space and quietness. I wished he would speak all night. When the telling was done, there was silence for a while. Then people began to talk quietly again. Neither Valiant nor Willow was there. People did not notice me, and so they spoke of the condor as they would not have done in the presence of my family. Shell was waiting for my grandmother to come back from the hayamas. She said, If those people are coming back, this time we should not let them stay in the valley. They're in the valley already, Hound said. They won't go. They are here to have a war. Nonsense, Shell said. Don't talk like a boy at your age. Hound, like Agate, was an educated person who often traveled to Kastohana and Wakwaha to read and talk with other scholars. He said, Blue Clay Woman, the reason I say that is that I have talked with men of the warrior lodge in the upper valley, and what are warriors but people who make war? And these are our own people, Five House people of the Valley of the Na, these warriors. But they have been talking and lending their minds to Condor people for 10 years now in those towns. Old Cave Woman, whose last name had come to her when she went blind, said, Hound, do you mean these Condor people are sick, that they have their heads on crooked? He said, Yes, I mean that. Somebody farther down the balcony asked, Are they all men, as people say? Hound said, All that come here are men, armed. Shell said, But listen here, they can't go around smoking tobacco day after day, year after year. That's nonsense. If some men in those big towns up valley want to act like boys of 15 and run around playing war, what's that to us here? All we have to do is just tell the foreigners to keep moving on. Mouse Dance, who was then speaker of my hayamas, said, They can do us no harm. We walk the gyre. Hound said, And they the wheel, and the power builds. Keep to the gyre, Mouse Dance said. He was a kind, strong man. I wanted to listen to him, not to Hound. I was sitting back against the wall of the house because I felt like staying under the eaves, out of sight from the sky. Between my feet something was lying on the floor of the balcony. In the starlight it looked like a bit of stick or string. I picked it up. It was dark, stiff, thin, and long. I knew what it was. It was the word I must learn to speak. I got up and took it to Cave Woman and pushed it into her hand, saying, Take this, please, it's for you, because I wanted to be rid of it, and Cave Woman was very old, wise, and weak. She felt it, and then held it out towards me. She said, North Owl, keep it. It was spoken to you. Her eyes looked straight through me in the starlight that was the inside of a cave to her. I had to take the feather back. She spoke more kindly then. She said, Don't be afraid. Your hands are a child's hands. They are running water through the wheel. They don't hold. They let go. They make clean. Then she began to rock her body and closed her blind eyes, and she said, Heya, Condor's daughter in the dry land. Think of the creeks running. Heya, Condor's daughter in the dark house. Think of the blue clay bowl. I am not Condor's daughter, I said. The old woman just opened her eyes and laughed and said, "It seems the condor says you are." I turned to go indoors, upset and ashamed, and Cave Woman said, "Keep the feather, child, till you can give it back." I went into our rooms and put the black feather into the lidded basket Willow had made for me to keep Hehole and remembering things in. Seeing it in the lamplight, dead black, longer than an eagle feather, I began to feel proud that it had come to me. If I had to be different from other people, then let my difference be notable, I thought. My mother was at the Blood Lodge. My grandmother was at the Hayamas. Through the southwest windows I heard the rain sound of the drums. Through the northeast windows I heard the little owl speak in the oak trees. Ooh! I went to sleep alone, thinking of the condor and listening to the owl. On the first day of the wine, some Madidino people came, saying that a lot of condor men were coming down into the valley over the mountain from Clear Lake. Nine Point was going down with his family to pick in the great Shipa vineyards on the valley floor, and I went to work with them. While we were picking, people came by saying that the condor men were coming on the old straight road, and we went there to see them pass. The image in my mind must be a memory, but it is like a wall painting, bright, crowded, and unmoving. Black and red condor heads in rows, legs and hooves of big horses, gunstocks, wheels. In my mind's image, the wheels do not turn. When we got back to Sinshan, the wakwa was beginning, and by sunset the drinking was well along. Yellow adobe people were laughing and dancing in the commonplace and starting to make whip heia ifs, and people of the other houses were drinking to catch up. Some children joined in the whips, but they soon became more roughhouse than dance, and most of us with first names went up into the balconies to watch the adults get wild. Dada of Old Red House, who was adult but could not think well, came with us. I had never watched the wine very long before. It had scared and bored me. Now, being nine, I was ready to see it. What I saw was the reversal. Everybody I knew had become somebody I did not know. The commonplace was white with moonlight and bonfires and floodlights and crowded with the dancing and the whips and the people clowning. A lot of the adolescents were playing throw the pole and were up and down ladders and stairs and all over the roofs and balconies and in the trees like shadows laughing and calling. An obsidian doctor, Peek, a shy, solemn man, had gone to his hayamas and got one of the big penises that the blood clowns use in the moon dances, and he had strapped it on and was running around poking it at all the women from behind. He shoved it at Corn Tassel, and she clapped her legs together on it and jumped forward. The strap broke, Peek fell flat on his face, and she ran off with the big penis, yelling, "I got the doctor's medicine." I saw Agate talking very loud, and dignified Shell, dusty and stumbling about after falling off the end of a whip, and my grandmother Valiant dancing with a bottle of wine. Then the first of the Domiadu Owe came out of the yellow adobe hayamas and across the hinge, uncoiling and uncoiling as it came, till its winged head was three times a person's height, and swayed above the lights and fires. Everyone held still as it began to weave the pattern, and then the drums began, and the whips went singing after the Domiadu Owe as it coiled along the paths from house to house. I had drunk a lot more wine that evening than I had ever drunk before, and now I felt that I had to hold on to the balcony railing to keep from floating off into the air. The Domiadu Owe came coiling down among the trees from up the hill house and closer to High Porch House. Its yellow head paused at our balcony and turned slowly, the eyes looking at each one of us. Inside the great eye, a small, deep, bright eye. Then it passed on, coiling and swaying in time with the drums. Dada had crouched down, hiding his face from the Domiadu Owe. A little boy of our house called Morning Lark was crying with fear, and I was comforting him, when another child said, "Look, who's that?" Some people had come across the bridge and were standing near Gairga Oaks. They wore black and stood there tall and still, like vultures in a tree looking down. People looked at them and then went on dancing the wine. The Domyadu Owe was going back towards the dancing place, and flute players were leading a stamp dance in the commonplace. A yellow adobe woman went up to the tall people and spoke to them, waving her arms, and then took them over to the commonplace where the wine barrels were set up on sawhorses. Four of them stayed there to drink, but the fifth one came back across the place, past the lights, through the dancing, to High Porch House. Looking down from the balcony, I saw my mother, Willow, coming across from the hinge, and at the foot of the steps of our household, they met. I ran into our second room. Soon I heard steps come up the stairs and come into our hearth room. She called me. I went into the hearth room. He was standing there. His black wings hung down and his red-beaked head touched the ceiling. My mother said, "North Owl, your father's hungry. Is there anything fit to eat in the house?" That was what we always said in Sinshan when people came, and they always said, "Only my heart was hungry to see you," and then we brought out food and ate together. But my father did not know what to say. He stood there looking down at me. My mother told me to heat up corn and beans on the stove. While I did that, I could look sideways at the man and see that he had a man's face. I had not been sure if the condor's head and beak were his headdress or his head. When he took the helmet off, I looked sideways again. He was a beautiful man, with a long nose, wide cheeks, and long, narrow eyes. He was looking at my mother, Willow. She was lighting the oil lamp we used at table. So much beauty had come to her that for that moment I did not know I was looking at my mother, but saw a stranger, a four-house person, standing there with brightness in her hands. They talked as well as they could. My father knew only parts and pieces of our language. Not many people from outside the valley had come to Sinshan in my lifetime, but I had heard traders from the north coasts and an amaranth man from the inland sea talking as he did, trying to pour water into a broken pot, as the saying is. His groping after the pieces of language he needed was funny, and I saw that he was a human person, however strange he was. Willow poured wine for the three of us, and we sat down together. My father was so big and long-legged that he made the table far too small and low. He ate all the corn and beans I had reheated and said to me, "Very good, good cook." North Owl is a good cook, and a good herder and reader, and has walked once now on the mountain, my mother said. As she seldom praised me, I felt as if I had just drunk the whole jar of wine. She went on, "If you've had enough to eat for now, husband, come out and drink. We all dance the wine tonight, and I want everybody in this town to see you." She laughed as she spoke. He looked at her, perhaps not understanding much of what she said, but with so much liking and admiration that my heart began to warm to him. My mother looked back at him, smiling, and said, "While you were gone, a lot of people kept telling me that you were gone. Now that you're here, I'd like to tell them that you are here." "I'm here," he said. "Come on, then," she said. "You too, North Owl." "What you call baby?" my father asked. My mother repeated my name. I said, "I'm not a baby." "Girl," my mother said. "Girl," he said. And we all laughed. "What is owl?" he asked. I said what the little owl says. "Oo-oo-oo-oo-oo-oo-oo." "Aha," he said. "Owl. Come on, owl." He held out his hand to me. It was the biggest hand I had ever seen or touched. I took it, and we followed my mother down into the dancing. Willow was full of beauty that night, full of power. She was proud. She was great. She drank, but it was not the wine that made her great. It was the power that for 9 years had been pent up in her and was now set free. She dances there. She dances there. She dances where she went, laughing among the people. It flashes It vanishes, firelight along the water. My grandmother got drunk and disorderly and spent the night in the barns gambling. When I came up to bed, I took my bedding out on the balcony so that my mother and father could have the rooms to themselves. I was happy thinking about that as I went to sleep, and the noise around town did not bother me at all. Other children slept on the balcony or in another household when their parents wanted to be by themselves, and now I was like those children. As a kitten does what all other kittens do, so a child wants to do what other children do, with a wanting that is as powerful as it is mindless. Since we human beings have to learn what we do, we have to start out that way. But human mindfulness begins where that wish to be the same leaves off. A year before this, now, where I write this page, after the Madrone Lodge people had asked me to write this story of my life, I went to Giver Ire's daughter, the story writer, and asked if she could teach me how to write a story, for I did not know how to go about it. Among other things Giver suggested to me was that in writing the story, I try to be as I was at the time of which I am writing. This has been a good deal easier than I thought it would be, until now. This place now, where my father has come into the house. It is hard to remember how little I knew, and yet Giver's advice is sound, for now that I know who my father was, why he was there and how he came, who the Condor people were and what they were doing, now that I am learned in such matters, it is my old ignorance, in itself valueless, that is valuable, useful, and powerful. We have to learn what we can, but remain mindful that our knowledge not close the circle, closing out the void, so that we forget that what we do not know remains boundless, without limit or bottom, and that what we know may have to share the quality of being known with what denies it. What is seen with one eye has no depth. The sorrow of my parents' life is that they could see with one eye only. All that grieved me, that I was half one thing and half another and nothing wholly, was the sorrow of my childhood, but the strength and use of my life after I grew up. With one eye I see Willow, Valiant's daughter, of the blue clay of Sinshan, who had married a houseless man, and had a daughter and 8 sheep in the family and the use of several gathering trees and a seed-grass place. With the man's hands to work, they could do more gardening and make more, and so perhaps do more giving than taking of things and food, which is a great pleasure, and live respected without any shame. With the other eye I see Terter Abhau, true Condor, commander of the Army of the South, who was off duty with his troops for the autumn and winter, awaiting orders for the spring campaign. He had brought his 300 back to the Valley of the Na because he knew the people there were rich and tractable and would house and feed his men well, and also because he had had a girl in one of the towns there 9 years ago when he was a 50 commander on the first exploration of the south, and he had not forgotten her. 9 years is a long time, and no doubt she had married some farmer of her tribe and had a litter of brats, but even so, he would come by the village and see her. So he came, and found his hearth fire lighted, his dinner ready, his wife and daughter welcoming him home. That was what he did not know that he did not know. From that first night of the wine, he lived in our household. Most people in town had no ill will towards him, since he was Willow's husband and had finally come back, but none of the houses of earth took him in. Even in Sinshan there lived one person born outside the valley. Walker of Blue Wall's house had come from the north coasts with traders 30 years before, and had stayed in the valley and married Toyon of the Yellow Adobe, and the serpentine Hayamas had taken him in. In the big towns, of course, there are many such people, and in Tachas-Tochas they say that all of them came from somewhere in the north, houseless people, how many hundreds of years ago. I do not know why none of the houses took my father, but I guess that their councils saw that it would not do. He would have had to study to learn what every child in the Hayamas knew already, and he would not have borne it, since he believed he knew all he needed to know. A door seldom opens itself to the man who shuts it. Maybe he did not even know there was a door. He was busy. Through the councils of the houses and the planting lodges of the four towns of the lower valley, he made arrangements for his 300. They were given eucalyptus pastures to use for their camp and horse grazing, down on the northeast side of the river, below On Malin. The four towns agreed to give them some corn, potatoes, and beans, and let them hunt from the hummocks down the inner northeast hills to the salt marshes, fish the river below the confluence of Kimmy Creek, and take shellfish anywhere east of the east mouth of the Na. It was a good deal to give, but, as people said, the only wealth is spending. And though 300 men would eat a lot, it was understood that they would leave the valley after the sun, before the world. That my father would go with them never entered my head. He was home. He was here. Our family was whole. Now everything was as it should be, balanced, complete, and so it would not change. Besides, it was entirely different from the men in the camp. He spoke Kesh, and lived in a household, and was a daughter's father. When he first took me down to eucalyptus pastures with him, I was not sure that the men there were human beings. They all dressed alike and looked alike, like a herd of some kind of animal, and they did not speak any word I knew. Whenever they came near my father, they would slap their foreheads, or sometimes kneel down in front of him as if they were looking at his toes. I thought they were crazy men, very stupid, and that my father was the only real person among them. Among the people of Sinshan, it was sometimes he who seemed rather stupid, though I did not like to admit it. He did not know how to read and write, or cook, or dance, and if he knew songs, they were in words no one understood. He did not work in any of the workshops, or at the winery, or at the barns, and never even walked through the fields, and though he wanted to go out with hunting parties, only the most careless hunters would let him come, because he did not sing to the deer, or speak to the deaf. At first they put it down to ignorance and did it for him, but when he did not learn appropriate behavior, they would not hunt with him. Only once was he notably useful, when the red adobe Hayamas had to be redug and rebuilt. Their speaker was very strict and did not like people from the other houses helping out, but since my father was a no-house man, there were no restrictions on his lending a hand, and his hand was a strong one. But he did not get much goodwill out of that work, because when people saw how he could work, they were more inclined to ask why he did so little. My grandmother held her tongue, but she could not hide her contempt for a man who would not herd or farm or even chop wood. He, holding herders and farmers and woodcutters in contempt, found this hard to bear. One day he said to Willow, "Your mother has rheumatism. She shouldn't work down there in that mud in the rain, digging potatoes. Let her stay home and weave in the warmth. I'll pay some young man to work your patch of land for you." My mother laughed. I did, too. It was a funny idea, a reversal. "You use money like this. I've seen it here," he said, showing a handful of rather poor money of different kinds from both coasts. "Well, of course we use money, to give people who act and dance and recite and make, for making, for the dances, you know. Whatever did you do to get paid that for?" my mother asked, laughing again. He did not know what to say. "Money's a sign, an honor. It shows that you're rich," she tried to explain. But he did not understand, so she said, "Anyhow, about the garden, our plot is much too small to be worth anyone's sharing the work with us. I'd be ashamed to ask." "I'll bring one of my men, then," he said. "To work our plot," my mother said, "but it's blue clay land." My father swore. He had picked up swearing before anything else, and swore well. "Blue clay, red clay, what does it matter?" he said. "Any fool can dig black mud." My mother sat spinning a while and said at last, "That's crazy talk." She laughed again. "If any fool can, why can't you, my dear?" My father said stiffly, I am not a chun. What's that? A man who digs dirt. A farmer? I'm not a farmer, Willow. I am a commander of 300. In charge of an army, I am. There are things a man can do and cannot do. Surely you understand that. Surely, my mother said, looking at him with admiration of his dignity. So it all passed without either understanding what the other said, and yet without anger or hurt, since their love and liking kept the harm from building up, kept washing it away, like the water in the mill wheel. When they were building the bridge across the Na, my father took me down to eucalyptus pastures every day. His dun gelding was twice the weight and half again the height of most valley horses. Sitting up on that horse, on the high-horned saddle, in front of the big man with the condor helmet, I felt as if I were not a child, but something quite different, something rarer than a human being. I would see and hear him speak to the men in the condor camp. Everything he said to them was an order, a direction that had to be obeyed without question or discussion. They never discussed anything. He would give an order, and the man he spoke to would slap his hand over his eyes and run to do whatever it was. I liked seeing that. I was still afraid of the condor men. All men, all tall, wearing strange clothing, smelling strange, armed, not speaking my language. When they smiled at me or spoke to me, I always shrank away and looked down, not answering. One day, when they were starting work on the bridge, my father taught me a word in his language, pies, now. When he signaled, I was to shout, pies, as loud as I could, and the men working would drop the pile driver, a big stone in a pulley. I heard my high, thin voice and saw 10 strong men obey it, over and over. So I first felt the great energy of the power that originates in imbalance, whether the imbalance of a weighted pulley or a society. Being the driver, not the pile, I thought it was fine. There was trouble, however, about the bridge. Ever since the condor soldiers had camped in eucalyptus pastures, groups of men from the upper valley towns kept coming down and walking past the camp, or staying in the hills above Onmalin vineyards, not hunting, just hanging around. These were all members of the warrior lodge. People in Tsinshan talked about them uneasily, with a kind of fascination, how the warriors smoked tobacco daily, how each of them had a gun of his own, and so on. My cousin Hops, who had become a member of the Bay Laurel, would not allow Pelican and me to be wild dogs when we played. We were to be condors, and he a warrior. But I said Pelican could not be a condor, since she was not a condor, and I was, partly. She said she didn't want to be either one, and it was a stupid game, and went home. Hops and I hunted each other all over Adobe Hill all afternoon, with sticks for guns, shouting, "Cuck, you're dead," when we saw each other. It was the same game the men down around eucalyptus pastures wanted to play. Hops and I were mad for it, and played it every day, drawing other children into it, until Valiant noticed what we were doing. She was very angry. She said nothing at all about the game, but put me to work shelling walnuts and almonds till my hands almost dropped off, and told me that if I missed lessons at the Hayamas once more before the grass, I would probably grow up to be a superstitious, ill-natured, mindless, repulsive, cowardly person. But of course, if that's what I wanted to be, it was up to me. I knew that she disapproved of the game, so I stopped playing it. It did not occur to me then that she also wished I would not go down to eucalyptus pastures with my father to see them building the bridge. The next time I went with him, the soldiers were not working. A group of warriors from Chumo and Kastohana had set up camp right between the pilings on the river shore. Some of the condor men were angry, I could tell, as they talked to my father. They were asking him to let them make the valley men move out of the way by force. He said no, and went down to talk to the warriors. I started to follow him. He sent me back to wait with his horse, so I did not know what the warriors said to him. But he came back up into the pastures looking fierce, and talked a long time to his officers. The warriors moved away that night, and work went on for a couple of days on the bridge, peacefully, so my father was willing to take me with him to the pastures when I asked. But when we got there that afternoon, there was a group of valley people waiting under the last of the great double row of blue gums that gave the place its name. Some of them came by and began to discuss things with my father. They said they were sorry that some young men had been rude or quarrelsome, and that they hoped it would not happen again. But on consideration, most of the valley people who had given thought to the matter had decided that it was a mistake to put a bridge across the river without consulting either the river or the people who lived alongside it. My father said his men needed the bridge to get their supplies across the river. There are bridges at Madidino and Onmalin and ferries at Blue Rock and Round Oak, a valley person said. They will not carry our wagons. There are stone bridges at Telina and Castoja. That is too far to go round. Your people can carry things across by the ferry, said Sunweaver of Castojana. Soldiers don't carry loads on their backs, my father said. Sunweaver thought this over a little while and then said, Well, if they want to eat the food, maybe they'll learn how to carry it. My soldiers are resting here. Wagons are for carrying. If our wagons cannot cross the river, your people will have to bring the food to us. In a pig's eye, said a man from Tachas Tochas. Sunweaver and others eyed him. There was a silence. We have built bridges in many places. Men of the Condor are not only brave fighters, but great engineers. The roads and bridges in the lands around the city of the Condor are the wonder of the age. If a bridge at this place were appropriate, there would be one, said White Peach from Onmalin. My father did not like to talk to women in front of Condor men, so he said nothing, and there was another thoughtful silence. In our judgment, Sunweaver said very politely, this bridge would not be in the right place. All you have going south is your railway with 6 wooden cars, my father said. A bridge here will open up a way clear to... He paused. Sunweaver nodded. My father thought hard and said, Listen. My army is not here to do any harm to the valley. We are not making war on you. As he spoke, he looked over at me once or twice, seeing me with half his mind as he worked to find the words he needed. But you must understand that the Condor rules all the north, and that you live now under the shadow of his wing. I do not bring you war. I only come to widen your roads and build you one bridge that something wider than a fat woman can get across. You see, I build it down here away from your towns, where it need not bother you. But you must not stand in our way. You must come with us. We're dwellers, not travelers, said Digger of Telinana, the speaker of the Blue Clay, a well-known man, quiet, but one of the great speakers. One doesn't need roads and bridges to go from room to room of one's house. This valley is our house, where we live. In it we welcome guests whose house is elsewhere, on their way. My father arranged his reply for a while in his mind, and then said in a strong voice, My desire is to be your guest. You know that this valley is my house, too. But I serve the Condor. He has given his orders. The decision is neither mine nor yours to make or change. You must understand that. At that, the man from Tachas Tochas twisted his head round on his neck with a grin, and he stood back from the group to signify that he did not consider it profitable to go on talking. A couple of the others did the same, but Obsidian of Onmalin stood forward to speak. She was the only person in the 9 towns at that time called by the name of her house, the best known of all dancers of the moon and blood, unmarried, single-sexed, a person of great power. She said, Listen, child, I think you don't know what you're talking about. Maybe you could begin to learn if you learned to read. He could not take that in front of his men. Though most of them did not understand her words, they heard the scorn and the authority in her voice. He said, Be quiet, woman. And looking past her to Sunweaver, he said, I will order work on the bridge stopped at this time, because I wish no harm. We will make a plank bridge for the wagons and take it down when we go. But we will return. It may be that a great army, 1,000 men, will come through the valley. Roads will be widened, bridges will be built. Do not provoke the anger of the Condor. Let them flow through the valley as the water through the wheel of the mill. My father's head was not on backwards. Even in these few months he had begun to understand the image of the water. If only he had been born in the valley. If only he had stayed and lived in the valley. But that, as they say, is water under the bridge. Obsidian walked away in anger, and all the people from Onmalin followed her except White Peach, who, with considerable courage, stood fast and spoke. Then I think the people of the towns should help these people carry the food we give them. Conditions upon gifts are odious. I agree, said Digger, and several others from Madidino and one from Tachas-Tochas. Digger added from the water songs, The bridge falls, the river runs. He opened his palms to my father, smiling, and stood back. The others with him did the same. That is good, my father said, and he also turned away. I stood there and did not know which way to turn, whether to go with my father or my townspeople, for I knew that despite their restraint there was anger on both sides, that they had not come together. The weak follow weakness, and I was a child. I followed my father, but I shut my eyes so that nobody would see me. The business of the bridge was patched up. The soldiers made a plank bridge that would carry their wagons, and the valley people brought supplies, a few sacks or baskets at a time, and left the stuff in a drying shed at Atsamye, where the Condor wagons could come pick it up. But the warriors kept hanging around, keeping watch on the Condor camp. And many people in Onmalin refused to give anything to the Condor men, or speak to them, or look at them, and started attending meetings of the warrior lodge. Obsidian of the Obsidian of Onmalin was one to hold a grudge. In Tachas-Tochas, an obsidian girl had made friends with one of the Condor men and wanted to come inland with him, but being only 17 and frightened by some things people had said to her, she asked for the consent of her heimas, which my mother Willow had not done in her day. The Obsidian of Tachas-Tochas sent people over to Onmalin to talk about it, and Obsidian of the Obsidian said, Why are these Condor people all men? Where are the Condor women? Are they ginkgos? Let them marry each other and breed whatever they like. Let this daughter of our house not take a man of no house. I heard about that. But whether the girl in Tachas-Tochas took this advice or went on meeting that young Condor, I do not know. Certainly she did not marry him. Between the grass and the sun, the warriors from up and down the valley held several wakwa along the old straight road and on the river banks, which they called purifications. Men had joined the warrior lodge in all the towns, as the Condor stayed on in the valley. My side-grandfather, Nine Points' son and grandson, joined them, and that whole family was busy for a while weaving them the special clothing they wore for their wakwa, a tunic and hooded cloak and dark wool, something like the Condor soldiers' clothing. The warrior lodge had no clowns. When some blood clowns from Madidino came to one of their purifications, instead of flighting with them or ignoring them, the warriors began pushing and pulling them, and there was some fighting and a lot of bad feeling. There was always sexual trouble and tension around the warriors, and some women in Sinshan whose husbands had joined that lodge complained about their rules of sexual abstinence, but other women laughed at them. In winter there are so many ritual abstinences for anybody dancing the sun or the world that another set of them really would not make a great difference, though it might be, as they say, the pin that made the donkey bray. My grandmother danced the inner sun that year, and I fasted the 21 days for the first time, and listened every night to the trance singing in our heimas. It was a strange sun. Every morning of that winter there was fog, and on many days it never lifted up higher than the foothills of Sinshan Mountain, so that we lived under a low roof. And in the evening the fog would settle back down to the valley floor. There were more white clowns than ever before that year. Even if some of them came to Sinshan from other towns, still there were too many. Some must have come from the four houses, from the House of the Lion, through that wet white fog that hid the world. Children were afraid to go out of sight of the houses. Even the balconies were frightening at dusk. Even in the hearthroom, a child might look up and see the white, staring face at the window and hear the stuttering. I had tended my seedlings in a place in the woods over the second ridge north of town, a long way, because I wanted them to be a surprise when I gave them. I had a hard time of it, making myself go there alone to look after them during the 21 days, because I was so frightened of the white clowns. Whenever the little bush birds or the squirrels chipped and tisked, I froze, thinking it was the stuttering. On the morning of the solstice, I went to get my seedlings in a fog so thick I could not see 5 steps before me. Every tree of the woods was a white clown, waiting and groping for me in silence. It was entirely silent. Nothing spoke. Nothing moved but me in all those white ridges. I was cold to the bone and cold to the soul. I had come into the 7th house and did not know how to get out again. But I went on, although the woods were so hidden and changed by the fog that I was not sure where I was at any moment, and I got to my little trees. I sang the sun heya almost with my mouth closed, because any sound was so awful, and dug up the seedlings and replanted them in the pots I had made for them, shaking all the time, hurrying and clumsy. I probably bent the roots. Then I had to take them back to Tsinshan. The strange thing was that when I came among the grapevines on Top Knot Hill and knew I was home, I was not altogether glad of it. Part of me wanted to be cold and terrified and lost in the fog. Part of me was at home in the 7th house, not in High Porch House. So I went up our stairs and woke my family to the sun. To Willow I gave a buckeye seedling, to Valiant a wild rose, and to Kills a seedling of the valley oak. The oak stands now where we planted it, on the west side of the oak grove, Gyrga, a spreading, shapely tree, not yet heavily girthed. The buckeye and the rose are gone. Before the sun was danced, and after it, my father was with us in High Porch House every night and morning. Valiant, who danced both the sun and the world that year, spent most of her time and all her nights down in the hayamas. Willow did not dance that year, and Kills was, of course, bound neither to fast nor to feast. At that time, knowing nothing about his people, I thought that he had no observances or wakwa at all, and stood in no relation to anything in the world, except the soldiers to whom he gave orders, and my mother and myself. He and Willow kept indoors together whenever they could that winter. After the sun, the low fogs gave way to rain, and a cold spell with snow up on Tsinshan Mountain like the flower dust on a miller's hair, and hoarfrost some mornings on the grass. My father had some fine red wool rugs which he carried to furnish his tent on March. He had brought them to us, and our hearthroom was rich with them. I liked to lie on them. They smelled of sweet sage and other smells I had no name for. The smell of the place my father came from far away in the northeast. We had plenty of firewood, applewood, since the town had replanted 2 of the old orchards. There was great peace by the fireside in those long evenings for them and for me. I think of my mother in her beauty by that fire, on the edge of the years of sorrow. It is like watching a fire burning in the rain. Condor messengers came down over the mountain to the commander of the army of the Condor. Kills said that night when supper was done, "We must go before your world dance, Willow." "I'm not going anywhere in this weather," said my mother. "No," he said, "it's better not." There was a silence. The fire talked. "What's better not?" my mother asked. "When we start home, I will come for you then," he said. She said, "What are you talking about?" They talked backwards for a while, he speaking about the Condor army coming back from a war on the Amaranth coast, she not acknowledging that she had begun to understand him. At last she said, "Is this true? You're telling me that you are going away from the valley?" "Yes," he said, "for a while, against the inland coast people. It is the plan of the Condor." She said nothing. He said, "A year, not longer than a year, unless I am sent for to Sai. At the very most, 2 years, no longer." She said nothing. He said, If I could take you with me, I would, but that would be dangerous and foolish. If I could stay, but I cannot. But you will wait for me here. She stood up from the hearth seat. The softness of the firelight fell from her and left her dark. She said, If you won't stay, go. Listen, Willow, he said, listen to me. Is it unfair to ask you to wait? If I were going on a hunting trip or a trading trip, would you not wait for me? You valley people, some of you leave the valley and come back, and their wives wait for them. I will come back, I promise you. I am your husband, Willow. She stood there between fire and shadow for a while before she spoke. Once, she said. He did not understand. Once for 9 years, she said. Not twice. You are my husband. You are not. My house holds you. It does not. Choose. I cannot stay, he said. She said, still speaking softly and clearly, The choice is yours. I am the commander of the army of the Condor, he said. As I give orders, I obey orders. In this matter, I have no choice, Willow. She moved away from the fire then and came across the room. You must understand, he said. She said, I understand that you choose not to choose. You do not understand. I can only ask you, will you wait for me? She said nothing. I will come back, Willow. My heart is here with you and the child, always. She stood beside the second room doorway while he spoke. My bed was just inside the doorway, and I could see them both and feel the pulling two ways in her body. You must wait for me, he said. She said, You have gone. She came into the second room and closed the door, which had been open for warmth. She stood there in the dark. I lay still. He said, Willow, come back. He came to the door and said her name again, angrily, in great pain. She did not reply. Neither of us moved. There was a long time, nothing happened, and then we heard him turn and stride across the hearth room and go down the stairs. My mother lay down beside me. She said nothing and lay perfectly still. So did I. I did not want to think about what had been said. I tried to go to sleep, and soon I did. In the morning when I got up, my mother had rolled up the red rugs and put them with my father's clothes on the balcony by the head of the stairs outside our door. Towards noon, my father came up the stairs and passed the rugs and clothes. He came in the door. My mother was inside. She did not look at him or answer when he spoke to her, and when he stood aside from the doorway, she left the house at once, going to our Heimas. He went after her. Some blue clay people came right out and kept him from going down into the Heimas. At first he acted crazily, but they quietened him, and Ninepoint explained to him that a man may come and go as he likes, and a woman may take him back or not as she likes, but the house is hers, and if she shuts the door, he may not open it. People had come to listen because of the noise he had made shouting at first, and some of them thought it was funny to explain such things to a grown man. Strength, a speaker of the Blood Lodge, scoffed at him. When he said, But she belongs to me, the child belongs to me, she began to do the blood clown turkey gobble around him, shouting, The hammer menstruates to me, they pleat the courage to her, and a string of reversal words like that. There were some people in town glad to see the Condor humiliated. I saw this from the balcony of our house. My father came back up the stairs. He kicked the roll of rugs and clothing in rage like a child and stood there in the doorway. I had gone back to the kitchen table where I had been making cornbread. I kept working there with my back turned. I did not know what to do, how I should act, and I hated my father for causing this uncertainty and misery. I was glad Strength had jeered at him and wanted to jeer at him, too, for being so stupid. Owl, he said, will you wait for me? Not expecting to cry at all, I began crying. If I live, I will come back to you here, he said. He did not come in, and I did not go to him. I turned around and nodded. When I looked up at him, he was putting on the Condor helmet that hid his face. He turned and left. Valiant had been weaving. Her loom was set up by the windows in the second room. When my mother came back to the house, Valiant said to her, "Well, he's gone, Willow." My mother's face was pale and furrowed. She said, "I have gone away from that name. I will go back to my first name." "Tohi," my grandmother said in a soft voice, as a mother says a baby's name. She shook her head. The second part of Stonetelling's story begins on side 5. Notes. 1. I go there. Except for the preterite went, the verbs in this verse and others in the same form are in a present tense used in telling myths, recounting dreams, speaking of the dead, and in ceremonial recitations. The English present participle translates this timeless present rather well. Going there, going where I went, crying beside the water, going there, the fog along the water. 2. So we walked in the arm of life. The Serpentine Codex may help clarify some of this imagery. In the left arm of the Heiaif, the symbol of the whole, the 5 colors ran black, blue, green, red, yellow, into or out from the center. The right arm of the symbol was white. The left arm was mortality, the right, eternity. 3. The copper snake, the mountain lion. The copper snake may have been a treatment ritual for sufferers of rheumatism. The mountain, Amakulkan, Grandmother Mountain, the springs of the river Na, and the town at the springs, Wakwahana, were the most centrally sacred places to the people of the valley. To go up on the summits of the mountain, in the tracks of the lion, or on the hawk's way, was a solitary spiritual excursion undertaken sooner or later, once or more than once, by most of the people of the 9 towns. 4. Are they ginkgos? The ginkgo tree is sexually dimorphic. Female trees are not usually planted near male trees, lest they be fertilized, since the fruit exudes a terrific stench. In Keshe literature, the ginkgo is associated with homosexuality, both in satire and in celebration. 5. We must go before your world dance. Imperfectly acquainted with the delicacies of Keshe verbal usage, Terterabhau used the pronoun we, which includes the person addressed, and a form of the verb go, which implies going a short distance for a short while. So Willow understood him as saying something like, "You and I might take a walk together sometime before the world dance." 6. Reversal words like that. In clown impromptus, language was deliberately dislocated for subversive effect, as in surrealist poetry and imagery. Abhau inadvertently made just such a dislocation by saying that his wife and child belonged to him. Keshe grammar makes no provision for a relation of ownership between living beings. A language in which the verb to have is an intransitive, and in which to be rich is the same word as to give, is likely to turn its foreign speaker and translator into a clown all too often.